log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Needless to say, the US government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Laurie Calhoun Ryder. This article is published under the heading America's Exceptional Amnesia. Here's the story. Needless to say, the U.S. government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Yet Americans are often hesitant to apply the label war criminal even to figures such as George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, whose global so-called war on terror has sowed massive destruction, death, and misery, adversely affecting millions of persons for more than 20 years. Nor do people generally regard affable Barack Obama as a war criminal, despite the considerable harm to civilians unleashed by his ill-advised war on Libya. Drone warrior Obama also undertook a concerted campaign to kill rather than capture terror suspects in countries such as Pakistan, with which the United States was not at war, and he armed radical rebel forces in Syria, which exacerbated the conflict already underway, resulting in the death of even more civilians. Obama's material and logistical support for the Saudi war against Yemen gave rise to a full-fledged humanitarian crisis, with disease and starvation ravaging the population. Moving a bit farther back in time, U.S. citizens and their sympathizers abroad typically do not affix the label war criminal to Bill Clinton either, despite the fact that his 1999 bombing of Kosovo appears to have been motivated in part to distract attention from his domestic scandal at the time. The moment Clinton began dropping bombs on Kosovo, the press, in a show of patriotic solidarity, abruptly switched its attention from the notorious blue dress to the war in progress. Throughout his presidency, Clinton not only bombed, but also imposed severe sanctions on Iraq, as a result of which hundreds of thousands of civilians died of preventable diseases. Despite knowing about at least some of the atrocities committed in their name by the U.S. government, including torture, summary execution, maiming, the provision of weapons to murderers, sanctions, preventing access to medication and food, etc., many Americans have no difficulty identifying other world leaders as a war criminal. while simultaneously withholding that label from their own leaders. Viewed from a broader historical perspective, none of this may seem new. During wartime, much of the populace dutifully parrots pundits and politicians in denouncing the foreign leaders with whom they disagree as criminals, while supporting the military initiatives of their own leaders, no matter what they do. In the use of the term of derogation war criminal, then, no more than a reflection of the tribe to which one subscribes, all wars result in avoidable harms to innocent, non-threatening people, death and maiming, the destruction of property, impoverishment, psychological trauma, and diminished quality of life for those lucky enough to survive. Given these harsh realities, some critics maintain that all war is immoral. But morality and legality are not one and the same, for crimes violate written laws. We know that the U.S. 2003 invasion of Iraq was illegal according to the letter of the law, not only because former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan plainly stated that it was, but also because the U.S. government drafted a war resolution only to withdraw it when it emerged that they did not have enough support to secure the needed U.N. approval. If U.S. leaders had believed that the invasion was completely legitimate according to the terms of the U.N. Charter, then they would have felt no need to draft a resolution in justifying it. Ex post facto, when it emerged that the alleged WMD serving as one of the primary pretexts for the war were nowhere to be found, the U.S. government claimed that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was simply a continuation of the 1991 Persian Gulf War, which had received the support of the United Nations, or was justified because Saddam Hussein allegedly tried to assassinate George H.W. Bush in 1993, or because previous UN resolutions relating to the disarmament of Iraq and the elimination of its biological and chemical warfare capacity implied that military force would be permissible in the event of Saddam Hussein's non-compliance. On the propaganda front, the U.S. administration also pumped through the media pretexts, such as that the people of Iraq needed to be liberated from their ruthless dictator, and it was high time to allow democracy to flourish throughout the land. People have been writing about war crimes for millennia, long before the establishment of the United Nations and the ICC, International Criminal Court. The framework proffered in 1945 UN Charter derives from the classical just war tradition. By definition, a war criminal is someone who commits war crimes. But according to just war theory, there are two ways to become an unjust warrior. One is to wage an unjust war. The other is to conduct a war unjustly. These two forms of injustice are outlined in the Jus ad bellum and Jus in bello requirements on a just war, the interpretive fluidity of which has often been seized upon by political leaders intent on waging war. Such leaders use just war theory opportunistically as a template in developing pro-war propaganda. The aim of the drafters of the UN Charter was to rein in such bellicose tendencies and thereby avert tragic and massively destructive conflicts such as the First and Second World Wars, by requiring explicit and intersubjective agreement among nations before a war could be waged. Deception is a form of coercion, which implies that a leader who offers false pretext to secure the approval of the UN Security Council, as did George H.W. Bush in 1991, is no less a criminal than a leader whose war objectively violates the written letter of the law, as in the case of his son, George W. Bush's 2003 invasion of Iraq. Indeed, in predicting how leaders will conduct themselves during the prosecution of war, there may be no dependable indicator than how they went about garnering support for it. By now, it is common knowledge that all of the proffered pretexts for the 2003 invasion of Iraq were bogus, from the non-existent WMDs to the alleged collaboration between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Given the many lies used to persuade politicians and pundits to support the invasion, no one should have been surprised when those who waged a criminal war proceeded to render and torture suspects, kill civilians at checkpoints, deploy white phosphorus and depleted uranium-tipped missiles, raise entire cities, and terrorize civilians with lethal drones. Biden's debilitated mental state and inability to keep his story straight is the perfect metaphor for the attitude of Americans toward war criminals. They blithely ignore or brush aside the crimes committed by their own leaders, while supporting policies which will intensify rather than resolve conflicts abroad.
Economic divide.
The future of the world is at risk due to climate change. All scientific data points to that. In this part of the world, West Asia, the situation is in a crisis mode due to lack of water. Add to that Turkey's many dam constructions, and that is a recipe for possible conflict with economic ramifications. Hi, I'm Kavit Afwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, West Asia climate crisis. Lack of water is a result of that, threatening the regional economies. Obviously, climate change has contributed to a major portion of that. But there are other factors involved. We're going to take a look at Turkey's dam projects. What has it done? It has altered the flow of the rivers like Tigris and the Euphrates. The impact on countries like Iran, Syria, and Iraq. That adds to risk of regional tensions. However, Turkey looks at the situation in another way. It has a claim according to how it sees it. It has a right to its water resources, and it's comparing its water to Arab countries' oil. Is it suggesting a swap?
In recent weeks, severe dust storms have disrupted daily lives in many countries in the West Asia region, including Iran, Iraq, and some Persian Gulf Arab states. The emergency situation in the region is part of the larger climate change crisis that is affecting different parts of the globe. The impacts could increase drought conditions, aridity, heat waves, and sea level rises. The severe weather conditions in the West Asia could seriously hamper the capabilities of the countries in the region to produce enough food. Decreases in food production and increases in grain prices could destabilize the already volatile region. Climate crisis was part of the reason why a war began on Syria in the year 2011. But apart from climate factors, man-made developments are also major factors in high levels of aridity and drought in the region. Turkey has been playing an unconstructive role in the current crisis. Critics say that it is restricting water supplies to Iran, Syria, and Iraq through dam building. The Euphrates-Tigris Basin is shared between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. Iran also comprises parts of the Tigris Basin. Approximately 90% of the water flow in the Euphrates and 50% in the Tigris originate in Turkey. Recent political tensions in the region and the emergence of terrorist outfits have hampered collective efforts to tackle the crisis. The World Bank has warned that Iraq could potentially suffer a 20% drop in water resources by the year 2050. However, Turkey's massive dam projects have contributed to rising levels of drought in the region. Since the 1960s, unilateral irrigation plans altering the flows of the rivers, coupled with political tensions between the countries, have strained relations in the basin.
When it comes to water resources, scientists have time and again warned not only about shortages that exist in many parts of the world, especially due to climate change, but also of the tensions that this would cause between countries who are vying for possession of the precious commodity. Now, this has given rise to the term water wars. Well, in West Asia, this is a matter of great concern, as evident in some of the online posts. Taking a look at our first post, Middle East and North Africa is the most water-scarce region in the world. Nearly two-thirds of the population are living in areas that lack sufficient renewable water resources to sustain current levels of activity and growth. Our next post, Iraq dust storm, flights grounded in Baghdad and Najaf as skies turn orange. Dust storms to have become increasingly common in the Middle East, experts blaming a combination of climate change and mismanagement of land and water, a lack of green areas. So that's how bad this area in West Asia is doing. Next up, Turkey. This tweet says Turkey has designed their dams so they can restrict water to Syria and to Iraq in order to make them more amenable to Turkish demands. Their officials have confirmed it. This is a continuation of this policy. And expanding further on Turkey's ambitions, the next post, Turkey is building dams to control and restrict the flow of water to northeast Syria. Now, digging deeper into this, Turkey proxies weaponizing water in northern Syria based on a report that has said Turkish-backed groups in northern Syria have weaponized water by building dams on a river that serves as a lifeline for communities living downstream in Kurdish-dominated areas. So a political motive there for Turkey. Then it goes on to say the SNA, or the Syrian National Army's blocking of a vital river during the region's driest summer on record, was a clear-cut example of using water as weapons of war. And finally, it goes to say the Khabur is a 320-kilometer-long or 200-miles tributary of the Euphrates, whose source is in Turkey but runs across much of northeastern Syria and through Hasaka. All right, so there you have some of the tweets, which, by the way, pretty informative from the people who are writing it. Let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. We have Ashok Swain joining us. He's a professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University, and he's also the UNESCO chair on international water cooperation, who joins us from Uppsala. All right, very good. Ashok Swain, welcome. The falling levels of the Tigris and Euphrates that you're well aware of, it warns of an impending water crisis. Countries like Syria and Iraq first, and then Iran also to suffer from this. And all three have actually accused Turkey of using its many dams that it has constructed, 22 on record, hoarding water along the Euphrates and the Tigris. How do you see this in terms of Turkey's ambitions here? Is Turkey guilty of hoarding the water and using it for political gains?
Turkey controls the upstream of Euphrates and Tigris River. And these two rivers are the main water supplier, at least to Syria and Iraq. The Turkey contributes almost 90% of water to Euphrates and 10% Syria contributes. But the Tigris River is 40% of almost 40% Turkey, around 40% Iraq, and 10%, 9 to 10% Iran. So those are the water contribution to the system. But country like Iraq, which almost get 90% of its water supply through these two rivers, 90% means Iraq situation is almost like Egypt dependence on Nile. So So I think it's a very important or the critical source of water supply, which is controlled by Turkey.
All right. Let's bring in now Arnold De Valle. He's an international lawyer and geopolitical analyst who joins us from Damascus to tell us at least the Syrian side of what's going on. Arnold De Valle, welcome. So Turkish leaders previously to have stated that their country has a right to the water resources that are available in the region running through their country and being sourced from their country. And it actually has made a comparison to how the Arab nations have the right to their oil resources, and therefore Turkey should have that right for its water. Now, does this mean that maybe Turkey is implying or maybe stating indirectly that it wants to exchange water for oil, as it has stated? Previous officials have actually pointed to that. And at this point, some are saying that that would mean that water is being used as a weapon.
As far as the Turkish leader guilty of basically implementing those kind of policies as concerns the water and basically what are natural resources belonging to sovereign states. Well, I guess the answer is in the question. I mean, all those resources are part and parcel of sovereign states. And as far as I know, there hasn't been any redrawing of borders. So what we are witnessing is essentially a cynical ploy by the Turkish authorities, obviously for internal political reason, to, in thus far as northwest Syria is concerned with the refugees, alleviating the burden on the Turkish economy. As you know, the Turkish economy has not been doing very well. The Turkish lira has been plummeting up by 75% the last 18 months. And so this is part and parcel of this kind of, you know, I'm going to go outside my own borders and fix internal problems by exporting it into not only into neighboring states, but also by accaparating natural resources so I can fulfill this project of somehow, and that goes to the heart of the question, expanding, because let's not forget that the ideology of the Turkish government is that of neo-Ottomanism, which bears on reclaiming parts of what used to be the Ottoman Empire.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Countries across the West Asia region are facing a bleak future when it comes to its water resources, brought on by climate change. In this in-depth section, we will look at the destructive effects and whether there are other factors that are exacerbating the situation. Well, when it comes to the West Asia region, it is home, first of all, to 10 out of the 17 countries that are currently facing extremely high water stress, experiencing things like declining rainfall or what's called desertification. The region is also experiencing soaring temperatures. Now, as you're about to see, this is a direct result of climate change, which has gripped many parts of the world, not just unique to this area. Even if global rises are limited to 2 degrees Celsius, average summer temperatures will rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the year 2050. And then we need to take a look at the consequences of these temperatures. Well, they're going to lead to increasing evaporation of things like the surface water, because it's forcing an over-reliance on things like aquifers. Again, this is the section of the ground that's been broken up for us to explain this, and groundwater supplies that are already at risk of over-exploitation. And that is, of course, something that's gripped many countries in the region when it comes to over-exploitation. Now, moving on, let's take a look at some of the stats that we have gathered from, in this case, in point, the years 2003 and 2010. And we're going to take a look at the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and the loss. In this case, we're going to take a look at Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran that are along the Tigris and Euphrates river basins. They've lost a lot of water. The figures vary, but they're estimated to be around 144 cubic kilometers of fresh water, of total fresh water that has been lost. And 60% of that loss was attributed to the pumping of groundwater from underground reservoirs. So that's quite a bit of water to have been lost. Next up, Turkey's southeastern Anatolia project. That is what it's called. They're really all over the place in terms of what Turkey has done. It's the largest and most controversial dam building program in the world, 22 dams that are either constructed or slated to be constructed along the two rivers and Turkey's borders that are with Syria and Iraq. Now, Turkey's dam and hydropower constructions on the Tigris and Euphrates have been estimated to cut water to Iraq by 80% in terms of Iraq, and then have cut water to Syria by 40%. These are big numbers. Obviously, some of the consequences, it has jeopardized agriculture and natural habitats. Okay. Now, Syria itself has also been directly impacted by Ankara's dam building project. Now, in this case in point, we're taking a look at what happened during the year 2006. That was very severe in terms of the drought that came upon Syria. And the devastation it caused for agriculture began from that year. And then, of course, the Turkish dam building contributed more to that. In terms of what it did, it forced large numbers of people into cities like Damascus. And it also has been linked to the social upheaval and unrest that led to the big social unrest of Syria that happened in the year 2011. Okay, now we're going to take a look at water withdrawal. That's the next issue that needs to be tackled in this whole notion of water resources not being available for the region. Let's move on to about water withdrawal in order to understand how Turkey's dam building has affected regional countries. So in terms of that issue, by 2011, Syria's total annual water withdrawal as a percentage of internal renewable water resources had reached 160%. For Iraq, it was 80% and 20% for Turkey. Obviously, these numbers have been are estimates, but they're quite a bit when you take a look at the amount, percentage-wise, of water withdrawal that has been done from underground things like aquifers, for example. Now, onto the next issue, and that's about control that Turkey has over the Tigris and Euphrates. The Euphrates River, Turkey controls 90% of it, Tigris 44%. Obviously, when you have that kind of card stacked for you, then there's a lot that you can do in terms of the control and what you want to get from that. Now, when it comes to control, Turkey holds almost all of the cards on this issue. Take a look at the percentages here when it comes to the Tigris and Euphrates. The Euphrates River, 90% control of the water flows that Turkey has control of. And then the Tigris, 44%, big percentages. Now, what kind of advantages does that give Turkey? Well, unfortunately, this is what Turkey's been accused of. Unfortunately for Turkey, that is. It has been accused of manipulating water scarcity, further its political agenda in terms of what it's doing. It's been accused of that. And also, Turkey has been accused of trying to become a regional water superpower. And, of course, that brings with it some advantages for Turkey, but how it goes about that and how the countries in the region are going to react to that is what the key question is over here. Let's talk about this a little bit more with our guest, Arno Develier, who's an international lawyer and geopolitical analyst, joins us from Damascus. Arnold, welcome back to Economic Divide. Let's take a look at what we're seeing here, the falling levels of Tigris and Euphrates, which obviously is an impending water crisis for countries like Syria, Iraq, and Iran, which have all accused Turkey of using their dams along the Euphrates and Tigris to hoard the water. Is Turkey guilty of this accusation that's been leveled against it?
Well, I mean, the humanitarian law depriving civilian population from access to food and or water and all basic necessities can be considered a war crime and or crime against humanity. Now, what one needs to understand is that this participate of a strategy that goes back to the Jeffrey doctrine, and which has been reiterated by somebody from the Pentagon, who's exclusively tasked with this situation, in at least in thus far as Northeast Syria is concerned, which is to basically deprive Damascus from all access to oil, wheat, and water, as it turns out. So this is just a part and parcel of the hybrid warfare.
Wow. Interesting statement there. Well, let's find out from Ashok Swain, who rejoins us. He's the professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University. What he thinks about some of the hoarding that Turkey has done. Ashok Swain, welcome back. Countries across West Asia, obviously, as we've said, they're facing a bleak future in terms of declining rainfall and lack of resources as a result. Climate change, obviously, is part of the reason over here, but also Turkish dam projects. What are your thoughts on that? Doesn't that pose existential challenges for the countries of the region?
It is getting more and more serious. As you know, there have been for the last decade and a half or decade, so at least the internal situation in Syria and Iraq was not good or was not conducive for them to demand or to agriculturally develop or to economically take a sustainable progress because of the internal conflict. But that has changed to some extent, to a large extent. Iraq has stabilized to a greater extent. At the same time, Syria is moving into some kind of peace and certain kind of cessation of hostility, at least. And I think they need demand. They need water. They need water for certain kind of, and also Iran. There is an issue, the demand for the increasing demand for the water for their own agricultural needs, for the drinking water, and all sort of other human health and development.
When it comes to the issue of dam building by Turkey, it's not just Iraq and Syria that are angered by Turkey's hoarding of water. Iran has faced frequent droughts in recent years, caused in part by climate change as well as dam building in neighboring countries. Tehran has said Turkey's upstream dam building on shared waterways was unacceptable and has called on Turkey to cease such activity. This was in particular in reference to the construction of dams on the Aras River. Tehran has loudly expressed its opposition to Turkey's dam construction on the border water resources, with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying such a Turkish move is not acceptable. It's worth taking a look now at the specifics of Turkey's dam building and the dangers that it poses to other regional countries. Over the past 50 years, Turkey's State Hydraulic Works, known by its Turkish acronym DSI, has been very active. It has built 22 dams and 19 hydropower plants on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The effect on downstream rivers has left large parts of Syria and Iraq in severe drought. Over the last two decades, the DSI also has been taking up water resources on both the Kura and Aras rivers. Compared to the projects on the Kura, Turkey has built a greater number of dams on the Aras, though with a lower capacity. From 2012 to 2014, Turkey constructed 6 hydropower plants on Aras and is currently planning 8 more. And potentially larger projects are still in the queue. Among these, the recently announced Soylemez Dam particularly stands out, with a planned height of 113 meters and a carrying capacity of 1.4 billion cubic meters. The project would create the fourth largest reservoir in Turkey. Iran's Department of Environment has already warned that Turkey's move to construct Ilisu Dam over Tigris River would pose a serious environmental threat to Iraq and eventually Iran by reducing the entry of Tigris water to Iraqi territory by 56%. Given all the challenges that exist behind Iran's water availability, Iran has not stood still and has aggressively tackled the problem. Iran has gone ahead with a project to desalinate seawater from the Persian Gulf and supply it to the arid areas across the country. The first phase of water transfer from the Persian Gulf to Kerman and Yazd provinces has already been inaugurated. And finally, Turkey's dam-building projects have not only affected regional countries, but also villages and towns inside Turkey. like the 12,000-year-old town of Hasankeyf.
I've seen the new city. I could never love a place like that. I'm from here. These caves are my home. My past is here. My roots are here. It is in these caves that my home resides. For me, luxury is not a house with all the comforts and latest trends. For me, luxury is this.
This ancient southeastern town is now completely submerged underwater, with the construction of the Ilisu Dam and along with it, the heritage and culture of this town, along with memories and the local population. That's the end of this segment.
In conclusion, it is abundantly clear that West Asia is facing water challenges, which poses potentially existential challenges for the countries of the region. That's right, existential. Well, the most critical problem, water security, is affected by the Tigris-Euphrates river system. Now, Turkey is controlling the distribution of this water, and as such, well, it can use it for its own political gains. We've said that. But it is up to regional countries to pressure Turkey diplomatically into working out a viable solution which can benefit all countries involved. That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for being with us. For Mika Vitahli and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom has a long history among Muslim clerics. This is the speech of the leader of the Islamic Ummah on January 13, 2020, by Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with the officials of the Martyrs Who Were Clerics Commemoration Congress. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure progeny, commemorating the religious scholars and clerics who entered into the field of jihad and who ultimately achieved the blessing of martyrdom is a very good course of action. This is important because Muslim clerics have always invited people to do good. If those who are inviting to good take a leading role in doing good themselves, it will be more effective. Invite people to do good with means other than your tongues. Our martyrs, religious scholars, were individuals who invited people to do good both with their tongues and with their actions.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
During the sacred defense, I saw many young Muslim clerics who were wearing a military uniform and a turban on their heads. They were in the midst of the military troops explaining religious rules for the young people who were engaged in jihad and carrying out their duties as clerics. But they were not satisfied with just doing these things. I saw them from up close and knew them. They themselves stood in the front lines of the war, and a large number of them were martyred. Well, martyrdom is not a new phenomenon for Muslim clerics. In our books in the seminary, we have two books by two martyrs, the first martyr and the second martyr. The first martyr, or Shahid al-Awwal, Sheikh Shamsuddin Muhammad ibn Maki ibn Ahmad Amili Nabati Jazini. And the second martyr, al-Shahid al-Thani, Sheikh Zainuddin ibn Ali ibn Ahmad Amili Juba'i. 2 or 3 years after beginning their studies, our students in the seminaries read the book, a commentary on Lum'ah. Lum'ah was written by the first martyr, and the commentary was written by the second martyr. They were two prominent martyrs and two stars in the world of Muslim clerics in terms of their scholarly status. Throughout the thousand-year history of Shia's jurisprudence, these personages were outstanding, both the first martyr and the second martyr. We have a third martyr as well, that is Muhammad Taqi Barghani.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
The very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Buildings have collapsed. Watching stuff like war and bloodshed makes me nervous. I'd better turn off the television. Nothing's more horrible than war, and of course, peace is one of the most beautiful words ever created. By the way, did you know that we have a Museum of Peace in Tehran? Taking a tour to this museum would be a good idea for today. Yes, why not? Stay with me. The idea of founding Tehran Peace Museum took shape following talks between the founders of the Tehran-based Society for Chemical Weapons Victims Support, SCWVS, and a coordinator for the International Network of Museums for Peace in 2005. The founders of Tehran's Peace Museum came to the conclusion that the suffering of Iranian people, which were caused by the enemy's chemical weapons, is a good reason for exhibiting the consequences of war and violence. Tehran Peace Museum was temporarily closed for public visitors in 2010 for redesign, and the new building with a completely new design was inaugurated in a ceremony in June 2011, attended by guests from different countries, including director of Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. Tehran Peace Museum has several features, such as it is the member of the International Network of Peace Museums. Its active members, particularly the museum guides, are the victims of war and chemical weapons. Tehran Peace Museum is linked to other peace museums around the world. Tehran Peace Museum pursues the goal of promoting the culture of peace. I am now in front of the entrance gate of Tehran Peace Museum, which is located at Park Shahr. Just beside me, there is a statue of a dove that is drinking water from inside a combat helmet. You know, dove is the symbol of peace, and this statue beautifully shows the significance of peace. Next to this statue, there is another statue which has the shape of the word Sulh, literally peace, with the beautiful Nastaliq-style calligraphy, and just above it, a dove flying. The color of this artistic craft is white, reminiscent of peace and calm and tranquility. So, let's go inside the museum to see what's exactly there. I am now in a big hall. In this hall, there are the busts of the world-famous people who have done something for peace. There is a writing explaining everyone's life and efforts just beside each of the busts. This is the bust of Henri Dunant, founder of the International Red Cross. Just beside this bust, we have the bust of Mahatma Gandhi. And here, there is a television which shows a movie about the first charter of human rights in the world, namely the Cyrus Charter. And just below the television, there is a version of the clay cylinder of the Cyrus Charter on which is written a declaration in cuneiform script. Oh, look at here, the bust of Adolf Hitler. You know, Tehran Peace Museum also reminds us of those who jeopardized world peace and security and caused human suffering. Hitler is one of those savages. Oh my God! In this part of the museum, there is the statue of Zahak, the snake shoulder. According to Iranian mythology, Zahak was an oppressor who was bound into the walls of a cavern on Mount Damavand by a person called Fereydun. This statue also represents Zahak being tied. Of course, we cannot discuss the spectacles of this museum in a brief radio program. But if you happen to take a trip to Tehran, make sure to visit this museum. The online display of this museum is also available for enthusiasts. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government. Particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Russian forces and their allies have gained full control of the town of Lyman in the Donetsk region. That's according to the Russian Defense Ministry. The railway hub lies on the road to the key cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which are still under Kiev's control. It is also located 40 kilometers west of the largest Donbass city of Severodonetsk, the current focus of the Russian offensive in the east. Luhansk's governor says Russian troops have entered Severodonetsk. Elsewhere in the south, local authorities say the southwestern Ukrainian port city of Mykolaiv came under Russian shelling on Saturday. The city is 60 kilometers from the Russian-held city of Kherson. Also, according to a regional military governor, Russian forces have pounded the district of the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv.
The road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias. The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We're on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. But we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
I am taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base. The remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike. Now these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive." As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this in the coming days and weeks will raise the Russian flag. Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, a belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy, accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the